This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, July 12th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.org. Her YouTube channel is youtube.com/VeraIcona100. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
Good.
Excellent.
I'm very good. And you?
Doing well.
Good.
Yeah, I had a pleasant surprise at work today, like a 2-inch beetle. I'm going, what is this? These aren't from here. I've never seen anything that huge.
In California? Oh my gosh.
Ghastly. Thing was enormous. It was like a 2-inch beetle. Freaked me out, but I'm okay now.
Did you dispatch it?
I didn't kill it or anything, but I just let my boss know. I'm like, watch out. There's like this monster in front of your door.
Oh my
goodness.
He's like,
yeah, I saw that. Yeah. I've never seen anything like that around here, but it really took me aback. You just don't see something like that every day.
Right. I mean, I know California has black widows and it has other things,
but
not great big, huge bugs. Those are usually in the south.
Brown recluses, too. Watch out for those things. Evil.
Really?
Oh, they're much worse than a black widow. Much worse.
Now, have you
just
seen one?
Look up a bite by a brown recluse on the internet. It's ghastly. Yeah, I have seen them. We have them all around. So when you're out kind of in the country, there's lots of them. And they tend to linger in corners.
Oh, my.
And they have a messy little web, too. There's no pattern to their web, so you just got to watch out.
Gosh, I grew up in California, and I never heard of brown recluse spiders until just
recently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're around, mostly in barns and stuff.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
All righty. So with that, I guess we can start with, I want to go over real quick. We left off last time kind of talking about that Polish law that, you know, supposedly went into effect to change the Jews' status.
Right.
Visas in Germany. So we have all these Polish Jews in Germany, and all of a sudden I think it was October 1938, we suddenly have this visa problem where all these Jews have to go update their passports and then they can come back. In the meantime, they're potentially going to become stateless burdens on the Reich. Well, I got this information from our Polish friend.
Wonderful.
I won't say his name to protect his identity. So he says, I have not localized an original source of the information, but many Polish websites mention the origination of the project of the law of March 31st, 1938, as early as 1936, by the then chief of consular services of the foreign ministry, Victor Tomir Dreimer. The project of the law should have been hastened through the parliament as a consequence of the Anschluss and an expected wave of Jewish repatriates from Austria. So basically what this could have been, but we cannot rule out a nudge from any outside source such as Zionists or even those who may have influenced some of these politicians in Poland, which was at the time being ruled basically by a military junta, however you say that. That this was kind of going to be the result of the Anschluss, that Poland did not want all these Polish Jews coming back from Austria or whatever. I mean, Jewish immigrants coming from Austria, not Polish Jews, but just any Jews. So could have potentially just been anti-Jewish views and didn't want all these Jews coming in from Austria as a result of the reincorporation into the Reich. So they were getting ready. But the only problem with that thesis, that it was potentially a result of the Anschluss, is that this was supposedly on the books in 36. It just wasn't passed until 1938. Now, the law is actually from March 31st, 1938. It's signed by the president and by the Minister of the Interior. Well, that's 8 months, fully 8 months before the Kristallnacht. So, you know, why would the Poles actually announce this to the Germans in October when it was on the books in March?
Interesting. Why would you think that they would do that?
Before? Yeah. So I'm not totally buying the Anschluss reason. Because, again, the Anschluss was in March 1938. Now, that is when the law went onto the books. Okay, so the Anschluss was March 12th, 1938. And this law went on the books on the 31st of March, 1938, but it was not actually put into effect until October 1938 at the end, just before the Kristallnacht.
So I wonder if whoever was planning the Kristallnacht, if they had decided on a particular date and had to set it up and had to get everything in place, and then they announced.
Right. I mean, that's really suspicious to let that sit for a full seven, almost 8 months before.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, oh yeah, we're going to have this go into effect now.
Right. And they announced that, on October 9th? Did the Polish announce that on October 9th?
Oh, yeah. I believe it was the 9th, and it was either the 9th or the 15th. Yes.
Okay.
And then the Germans had until, I think it was like the 29th or the 28th to get all these people basically across the border.
Right.
Before it actually went into effect.
And on the 30th, Germany asked that these Jews be allowed to return. So
yeah, exactly. So they got them all gathered up by the 30th. They had to be there on the border ready to go back across the border. And of course, the Poles said no. They're not coming back. And these were Polish Jews. I mean, they were Polish citizens, merely working and doing business and other things in the Reich. So the Poles are refusing to take their own citizens. This is very strange. I'm sorry. The whole affair is so strange. It reeks of some kind of conspiracy.
Right. Because then it was a week later that Greenspan shot Ernst von Rath.
Exactly. Right. And of course, he claimed allegedly that it was because of the atrocious behavior of the Germans. Well, wait a minute. The Poles are the ones that did this in the first. This never would have happened at all. None of this repatriation would have happened if Poland had not pushed that through and enacted that law.
And how could this happen if they just asked these, Germany asked that the Jews be allowed to return, I mean, on the 30th? I don't know. Yes, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Exactly. It doesn't. And then in this Kristallnacht, the unleashing of the Holocaust by Reed and Fisher, we get right here. But in the cities where most Jews lived, okay, so this whole thing where most Jews live in the cities, they also mentioned that Czechoslovakia was in fact, and so in Poland too, now they say this, were France's satellite states. So they're basically saying that France is the de facto ruler of both Poland and Czechoslovakia at the time of quote-unquote German aggression. I thought that was really interesting. And of course, the French took quite a bit from Germany. Let's see, they were forced to hand over their colonies, forced to hand over large tracts of land in Posen and West Prussia to the newly restored Poland, the provinces of North Schleswig to Denmark, Malmedy and Eupen to Belgium, Alsace and Lorraine to France, the area around Teschen or Oderberg to the new state of Czechoslovakia, and Memel to Lithuania. And then, of course, we know the seaport of Danzig was declared a free city, but it was linked to Poland. So this really gives you a very good idea of what Germany was reclaiming. So this idea that Hitler is this loose cannon aggressor, totally debunked in this book. So it's kind of one of those books that you're like expecting to read a real anti-German screed, but it has, you know, jewels in it. And here's another thing that I thought was really interesting from this book. These two authors go so far as to claim that the inflation was actually Germany's weapon against France. It was done deliberately to get out of the crippling reparations payments.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you know, allegedly the German leadership was willing to put Germans through that to get back at France. I don't know if I buy that or not.
I don't.
That would be awfully malicious of the German leadership. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, some of these things they're putting out there are quite revealing of their agenda. So, you know, this is one of these books that has these nice little tidbits in here that give us more insight into what was going on.
Right.
So, interesting, because they're basically trying to put France up there as kind of a victim of Germany. You know, they did this hyperinflation thing to get out of their payments. That puts France as kind of the victim, you know, like,
sure.
We're not going to pay you.
But they paid quite a lot even before
they did.
Hitler came to power in 33. So
right.
I think they probably, well, for one thing, why was Germany required to pay all the reparations for a war that they didn't start to begin with? And,
exactly.
And by the time that Hitler did come to power, they had paid most of what was required.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that kind of undermines this argument, but still, these authors reveal these things, perhaps unwittingly,
right.
Which gives us more insight into the machinations against Germany.
Right. Actually, Herbert Hoover is the one that said, oh, it's okay, let's just relax these reparations. And mm-hmm. he was in from 1928 to 1932, so we know
right.
that reparations weren't really an issue.
Right.
During that
so
time.
Why would it be used as a weapon?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And yet these two authors say that. Very interesting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think the book is worth reading just to get this insight into these various things. And then, of course, back to Bard's book, that 48 Hours of Kristallnacht. He's saying in some remote village of Hingen, a village near Aachen, near the Belgian border, a small Jewish community. Again, who would know that Jews were in these tiny little, you know, off-the-wall communities to enact the Kristallnacht against them? You know, and then these authors are saying most of them lived in the cities. That's where most Jews were known to dwell. Just all kinds of problems that they run into when, you know, they contradict each other.
Right.
So, yeah, but that clears up that Polish thing.
Well, yes, that is very interesting. It would have been nice to know exactly who authored the law, other than just the Polish government, or...
Supposedly, it was the Minister of the Interior.
Oh, right, yeah, you said that. Okay, what
yeah.
was his name, I wonder?
But, I've got his name. Is something like
Goldstein
Schlesbach or something like that? No, actually, it doesn't sound Jewish at all. I believe one of them is Sklodkowski. You know what? I'll send that to you.
Okay.
He might not have been the actual signator. He might be. He does have an SKI last name, but that doesn't necessarily mean he was Jewish. And the individual who looked this up did not suggest that any of these people were Jewish.
Okay.
But it's still, the timing is strange. There's still unanswered questions, but it does clear more up for us.
Right.
Raises some new problems, though,
right,
doesn't
that's
it?
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Cleared that up.
It clears up some stuff, but it raises other issues. Yeah,
yes.
That's true. Okay, so with that, there are no issues, however, with the Reichstag fire. So, you know, I'll just go through, like, chapter by chapter.
All righty.
Basically, Fritz Tobias's book, The Reichstag Fire. And just for the record, Tobias is not pro-National Socialist. He's very anti-National Socialist.
He sure is.
And he's anti-communist. I think Tobias is a true liberal Democrat in the Masonic mold, you know, the whole democratic democracy based on liberal values. That's what he strikes me as, because he goes after the communists and the National Socialists as these harebrained extremists that were out to basically discredit one another through this trial. There is some merit to this argument that the two were basically using this as their political trump card against the other party, but they had good reason to do so. The communists, because they knew that Hitler coming to power was the end of communism in Germany. It was over. This was its death knell. So, you know, they had good reason to do as much damage as they could to the credibility of the Hitler government with this trial by claiming that van der Lubbe had NS accomplices, undoubtedly, which he didn't. And Tobias proves that, as the trial itself did. But then on the other hand, the National Socialists, and Hitler's goal all along was to sweep away every single party and to just have one party, one government, one people, this whole oneness, unity, united front kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So everybody knew that was what, you know, what was coming. And so the National Socialists had it in their interest. And of course, also just the communist threat that they lived through, the 1919 stuff, all the violence that they had encountered over the past 14, 15 years. Tobias mentions that thousands had fallen in this 15-year struggle. So, you know, basically the way we need to look at this from the NS perspective is this trial kind of marked the end of a 15-year civil war in Germany. And this was a battle in itself. This was part of the war, this civil war. So they took it very seriously and they wanted to send a real strong message to any communist. It's over. Of course, van der Lubbe acted alone. He did not have communist accomplices that could be proven in any way, shape, or form. So what ended up happening is the National Socialists really lost the trial because they had to acquit all of the suspects except for van der Lubbe, the only one who could actually be tied to the crime and who admitted that he had acted alone and that he was trying to get some kind of, you know, communist KPD revolution sparked against the Hitler government that he saw as a threat to the workers. Now, the thing is unfortunately, poor van der Lubbe, you know, this kid apparently broke with the Dutch Communist Party. He was disgusted with the communists for, you know, bowing down and letting the National Socialists come to power unchallenged. So, you know, he broke with communism and he was kind of doing this on behalf of the German workers all in vain. And this kid did everything in vain. The workers didn't need him to do this because Hitler was not going to be a capitalist appendage who oppressed the workers. He, in fact, proved himself far more friendly to workers than any communist government ever in history.
Or any that promised that they would.
Exactly. Hitler actually did it, whereas the communists just said they would, and they erected these hideous dictatorships that were never about the rule of any proletariat. You know, they may have raised some have-nots into power. We talked about that a little bit with the Stalin's Folly discussion. And, you know, those people were relentless with their, you know, former capitalist enemies, if you will, the landlords and whatnot. But look at what they sold out for. I mean, they were all torturing each other. It was a hideous, repressive system that took millions of lives. Tens of millions, if you accept the figures of most historians. Was it worth it? I mean, it's just incredible. Of course, Dimitrov was one of the defendants at this trial. He was a Bulgarian communist and, incidentally, the head of the West European Comintern. Now, it was a good thing that he was detained during this trial, which lasted, I think it was a full eight, it was either 8 or 9 months, because the damage he could have done in the meantime, had he not been incarcerated for this trial as a suspect, who knows? I mean, he could have been making contact with the Red Orchestra. He could have been, you know, arranging contacts with agents, setting up the network far more than it even was set up. So we must be thankful that he was unable to do, you know, any damage in that respect. Now, the National Socialists that detained him never figured out that he was the head of the Comintern. And he explained away the documents that he had on him. So, actually, Dimitrov was guilty. He was head of the Comintern. Guarantee he was doing subversive activities, being a Bulgarian expellee in Germany. And he had quite a fervent interest in German politics and what was going on with the German Communist Party. So in that respect, he was very guilty. And he actually could have been put to death if the NSDAP had known he was head of the Comintern.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So he got off. He was acquitted. And I believe he was released. He had to have been released, yeah, because he ended up going to Moscow later. So I don't know how quickly he left Germany. I didn't really look into that. But he was acquitted as being a participant in the fire. Of course, he had very strong alibis, you know, undoubtable alibis, in fact. But again, Comintern.
Yes.
So in that respect, very much guilty of subversive activities against the new German government. There's no question about that. He just didn't happen to take part in the fire. As far as van der Lubbe, there are most legal experts say that the NSDAP was... they had unlawfully put him to death because it was like a law that was put into effect after the fire kind of a thing. But again, we're talking about kind of a Civil War context. Hitler is just in the door. The man hasn't even been given a chance to rule. And some communist sets fire to the Reichstag and expects lenient treatment. I don't think so. So, you know, extraordinary circumstances. We need to think of it that way. In that respect, I think the National Socialists had claimed to do that. You know, it was justified from their point of view, and he was sentenced to death and was beheaded, I believe, in December 1933. Beheadings were not that common in NS Germany, but it did happen. For high treason, Hitler basically could... He could say that that was too extreme in certain cases of high treason, but anyone guilty of high treason was basically beheaded, unless
wow.
Hitler said that was unnecessary.
Well,
right. It was pretty extreme. They weren't joking around. It was either hanging or beheading.
Well, I certainly, they called him a congenital idiot, a juvenile delinquent, a pathological vagrant, a pathological liar, a pathological boaster. And they also claimed that he was a homosexual prostitute in the service of the Nazis.
Oh, all lies. He was a very intelligent, well-spoken, idealistic young worker. You know, the police were impressed with him. When they did the whole fire reenactment, he got through the entire Reichstag and did everything he had done during the fire in the same time, within the time frame. So they said absolutely possible he could do it. He just replicated it. And of course, the replication was even faster because he was already one time familiar with the Reichstag. So
sure.
It was a little bit faster during the subsequent reenactment, which makes perfect sense. It should have been a little faster. And it was, they said he was drugged by the NSDAP. Now they brought in psychiatrists and a Dr. Carl Sudermann to prove that that was in fact not at all the case. He was never drugged by the NSDAP. What happened is he became apathetic and just didn't want to speak anymore. would occasionally burst out in hysterical laughter at the judges and his fellow defendants, like Dimitrov, who were adamantly, you know, you had accomplices. Tell us who they were. And Dimitrov, of course, was going, who were your Nazi accomplices? And the judges are going, who were your communist accomplices? He's like, I didn't have any. I did the whole thing myself. I explained to you every aspect of this whole thing. There were no accomplices. So, of course, he found it rather hysterical. Just these experts and all the witnesses that were lying. And they bald-faced lied in court. And here's the most interesting part of this trial. Torgler, who was the KPD man implicated, who was completely innocent, he had, like, no attorney would take him, basically. And so what ended up happening is a National Socialist attorney took his assumed his defense, Dr. Sack. And Dr. Sack got him acquitted. And he was extremely capable and defended him to the utmost. So that's one of those interesting things. If this trial was in fact completely farcical, as many say today, then there's no way a National Socialist attorney would have gotten his communist defendant acquitted.
Right.
You know, it was pretty fair. It really was. Now, when you read this, you see that the judges in the court, this Judge Vogt, V-O-G-T, Vogt, he was really, you know, more or less a clown because, you know, blatant lying witnesses, things that he knew where somebody was innocent, he'd wipe it away and then go with some ridiculous eyewitness who was basically a psychopath to uphold this case of accomplices that just couldn't be upheld. Now, he was under a little bit of pressure from the new government, of course. You know, he didn't want to say that there were no accomplices when Hermann Göring and Hitler himself were screaming to string up these communists. The entire Communist Party had to go on the night of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is they were reacting more or less to the situation after feelings had calmed down. I mean, clearly, if the judge could not establish that there were any accomplices, then, you know, we can't really run with that theory. It was completely undermined by the trial. So there were no accomplices on either side. Now, that didn't stop Willy Münzenberg in Paris, of all places, the head of Agitprop, from putting out these brown books and, of course, completely fraudulent memorandums that never existed, you know, blaming the NSDAP.
Right.
And saying that van der Lubbe was an idiot who was a tool of the NS party. And of course, the brown books are the reason today we still have the lies coming from within the truth movement about NS complicity and orchestration of the Reichstag fire. That whole case, anyone that says that Hitler did it to take away gun rights, I don't care what it was, suppress the German people, any of that, which didn't in fact happen.
Right. And also,
is based on the brown books.
And they always associate it with the enabling laws.
Right. The enabling laws would have come to pass anyway. And even Tobias has quotes from Göring stating that very thing. Hermann Göring says, we didn't need, he flat out says it during the trial, we did not need this fire to go after the Communist Party or the SPD or any party for that matter, nor did we need it for the enabling laws. That was going to come anyway. I mean, our intentions were clear from the beginning. It was going to be a clean sweep. We're the ones in power. It's going to be a new Germany, united front, central government with the state subordinate to that central government. No more of this Bavarian, you know, threat to break away or become a Soviet satellite. That's over. And so everybody knew what was coming. You know, the parties all, quote unquote, voluntarily went to their death, as they like to say. They all basically said, all right, we're going to give this Hitler guy a chance. So they voted for it. Overwhelmingly yay, not nay. And the SPD was allowed to vote on the enabling laws. Okay. So the SPD was not barred. They were not intimidated. That is all myth. They voted entirely freely on that. And they completely dissented. They were the only party that dissented. So they all gave a no vote. Nobody was killed or beat up for doing that. They just basically did it as a protest. And, you know, of course, Hitler's not going to be very friendly to a party that completely voted no and tried to prevent him from doing what he wanted to do. So, you know, of course, the SPD got a little bit of the brunt from this this fire and from, you know, the alleged Communist Party connection to it that, you know, the NSDAP suspected. At least Hitler, Goebbels, and Goering did. But, you know, they all used the trial, Goebbels and Goering did anyway, to clear their names. And it just became this big political kind of circus. It really did. The NSDAP was trying to not only clear its image and name of the slanderous lies in Willy Munzenberg's Brown Book, going out all the time, accusing everybody of doing things they did not do. And, you know, Goebbels orchestrating the fire and the SA involvement. Totally invented. It was all Willy Munzenberger's fantasy. So, you know, they were using it as their opportunity to clear their names. And of course, Dimitrov and a couple of the other communists, the Bulgarian communists, were using it as their opportunity to advance the communist agenda and use it as kind of a communist speaker's platform. So it got kind of comical at times.
Right.
And
you know, it was only just one room. You know, we think about the Reichstag fire as the whole building burned down, but it was really just the debating chamber that was burnt out. And
yeah. Session chamber. Yep, that was it, really. And I mean, the only thing that caused most, the reason why it had such vast destruction in that particular chamber wasn't because there was any, you know, petrol or whatever they tried to say with these experts that were basically totally inventing nonsense, but because of the updraft, as a result of the dome shattering.
Right.
Yeah, that's what caused it to just, you know, take off in quite a blaze. So yeah, exactly. The restaurant fire is where that's where Van der Lubbe started. That was put out relatively quickly. Because there really wasn't anything much to catch fire in there, and there was no updraft. So, you know, the other areas where he tried to burn, just it wasn't as successful. Now, he had started 4 previous fires before this one. So let's see. I'll just flip to that real quick. And real quick before I get to that, the Skronovitz claimed to have seen more fires than the others. The only reason he saw more fires is because of the highly polished tables. They were reflecting fire. So he thought he saw more than he did, but he didn't. So that undermined the accomplice's thesis because there weren't as many fires as he thought that were set. And of course, Tobias has not only Van der Lubbe's route, like a map of it, but also which fires were, you know, how the fires looked. When two police eyewitnesses looked in at it, and they said, no, we saw something different from Skronovitz, but again, he saw reflections.
Right.
Whereas police had been looking at the fires longer and realized they were reflections. So they reported fewer. And Skronovitz had only gotten a quick glance at it, so he thought he saw more than he did. Okay, so these 4 fires that Van der Lubbe had started, it was the first thing was the Neukölln Welfare Office. So that was fire number 1. And of course, we already talked about how the roofing had caught fire despite the snow, because these fire lighters he was using were extremely effective. The second fire was the town hall. And that he got there at about 7:15 p.m. and then started that one. So fortunately, Kiekbusch, one of the, I think he was an engineer. I think he was an engineer. Anyway, he caught the fire in time so that it didn't cause more extensive damage, but he didn't report it because people had apparently, out of just maliciousness, like passersby, had flicked burning cigarette butts through the windows on numerous occasions.
Oh, gosh.
So that's why he didn't report it. Because, you know, people go, well, why wasn't it reported? You know, they think there's some conspiracy. No. No, he only let his superiors know. And they're like, don't make a big deal out of trifles. That happens all the time. And then, of course, his next objective was the Imperial Palace. And there was a window that was slightly ajar, and it was just enough to where he could throw in some fire lighters. So that was the third fire, the Imperial Palace. That was put out relatively quickly because there was a witness who saw it in time. That fire was in fact reported, and a story about it was published on the very day that the Reichstag went up in flames on February 27th. And it said, but it is thought to have been an act of incendiarism. So, you know, they even put that in the report. Of course, at the time, there was the police investigation was not yet concluded. But if the NSDAP or anyone else had read that report of that fire on the 27th, they might not have been as fanatical, you know, about the Reichstag thing. But then again, maybe they would have. Maybe they would have gone, look, we had two fires set by incendiaries in the same day. This is a communist uprising.
Sure.
So I guess it could have gone either way.
He was quite a busy boy, wasn't he?
He was. And he was doing this as a protest, and he said that. He said, I am protesting the Hitler government. And the reason the communists had such a thing about the Hitler government is because they strongly believed communist propaganda that Hitler was going to resurrect the old capitalist, you know, everything for the few, nothing for everyone else system. Fascism was just another form of capitalism, and it was not going to be good for the workers. That's why they protested, and that specifically why he protested. He didn't think it would be good for the workers, and he claimed to be doing it on behalf of the German people who were sold out by their KPD, their Communist Party. Again, it was in vain. Unfortunately, this young idealist got in with the wrong crowd. And they deceived him with their propaganda, and he basically lost his life for this.
Yes.
Wasn't worth it. Obviously was not worth it.
And although he didn't have any accomplices in the actual act, he certainly had influence to do these kinds of things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The Communist Party and the whole agenda, the whole MO of communism was his accomplice. So, yes, in that respect, communism was definitely his inspiration. And whether or not there were other people who had suggested such things like, you know, maybe we should torch certain buildings as an act of protest to get a revolution started. I mean, that is a crime against any government. If you or I went out and torched four government buildings.
Oh, yeah.
Test to the Obama administration, that would be a crime.
Of course.
Be worthy of a death sentence in some states. I don't know. So yeah, exactly. You know, this is a crime by any standard. If it had been a communist government and a national socialist had done this, they probably would have also been given the death sentence.
Of course.
In the most extreme manner, beheading or hanging. So, you know, Hitler wasn't overly, you know, vicious or anything like that. This would have been taken very seriously by any government, even today.
Sure.
Tobias makes a good point. The Capitol would have been in a frenzy had all three of the first fires burned as they should have, had all these buildings gone way up in flames. And again, I think this probably would have lent more credence to the idea of a communist uprising, because he got around quickly. You know,
sure.
He was quite athletic, very fit, and very determined. This was his sole protest that he went to Germany, I guess, strictly to do something just like this. why a Dutch communist had such intensive interest in German politics. You know, why were the Bulgarians in Germany? Why was this Dutch communist in Germany? It's like, go to your own country and get your revolution started.
I think that they recognized that Hitler was different, that this was going to be a change, and that it might be a significant change for other countries as well. And and of course, communism is an international movement, so
right. And yeah, that's, people should think about that too. Clearly, there was something extra interesting about Germany and their political situation, and the fact that Hitler just came to power in January, that a Dutch communist goes to Germany and does this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, people really don't think about what was going on here. This wasn't international playground time. I mean, Germany had been like an international playground of intrigue for all these different expats and expellees who had failed to achieve their communist revolution in Bulgaria and Holland and whatnot. So we'll just come do it in Germany. I mean, that was outrageous. When we really think about it, that's an outrageous thing to do.
Yes.
So, you know, Hitler and Goering were furious. I mean, Goering did not back down. And he took on Dimitrov in the courtroom and was just as bullheaded and fervent about communist accomplices as Dimitrov was about NS accomplices of van der Lubbe. So, you know, those two going head to head is kind of an interesting debate to read. And Tobias gives quite a bit of their testimony. Of course, you know, the Reichstag fire came up at the IMT, and Goering was 100% honest. The incredible honesty of not only van der Lubbe, to his credit, but Goering at the IMT. Goering wasn't a liar. Now, he may have had an agenda. Okay, he had an anti-communist agenda and convinced himself that this was a Communist Party act, and that he must have had accomplices. But he really believed it. Even in, with the lack of evidence, he really believed it, and so did Hitler, as we've already realized from the table talk, where he mentions that he still thinks Torgler was guilty, but he just couldn't prove it. So they weren't liars, self-deceived perhaps about the communist threat at the time, but not liars, and certainly not Goering. He was a very honest defendant at the IMT.
Right.
And of course, that, you know, this came up and they had nothing new, at all. And they asked Goering, do you think now that perhaps van der Lubbe did do it by himself? And Goering said, yeah, you know what? I think now in retrospect, that's possible. I can't say for sure, but it's possible. So he had conceded a bit on that point. Of course, fire number four is the Reichstag. So,
yeah, it's interesting that Tobias includes the actual questions and everything at the IMT. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad he does, because he really gives the whole thing fair treatment.
Right.
His bias is obvious, but pretty fair. You know, I guess this is as objective as you get for the 60s.
Mm-hmm. That's for right.
Sure. In his book, he was viciously attacked by everybody. They were outraged, especially Der Spiegel. They just couldn't believe he had exonerated the NSDAP of the Reichstag fire. How dare you? So, you know, he was threatened for publishing this, which, you know, makes sense for that time period. That's when it was really starting to get insane.
Right.
Mid-60s to the 70s, especially in the United States, the 70s, as we know.
Sure.
That Skokie March. That touched it off, didn't it? With all those Holocaust survivors in the community.
Oh, my word.
Too coincidental.
Yes.
Of course, the curtain thing. There was an expert Schatz, Dr. Schatz, who claimed that the curtains, you know, could not have been burned, as van der Lubbe said, accomplices, blah, blah, blah. But in fact, those curtains had not been treated for, you know, being inflammable. They did this treatment to them, the Germans did, that made them not burn. Well, the Reichstag fire curtains were ignored for some reason. I guess they wanted their government officials to burn if a fire ever broke out. But the tapestries weren't treated. And so they did burn. Now, Schatz had these similar material, like similar curtains, that had been locked up in this chest for who knows long. So they were sealed, protected, blah, blah, blah. And he says, see, look, when I try to set fire to them, they don't. But as we saw in the courtroom, that doesn't fly. You had these ones sealed, they're treated, and you know, the wear and tear, the dust, etc., didn't affect the treatment, whereas it did on the tapestries in the Reichstag.
Sure.
So those ones did burn without any petrol or anything, whereas the ones in the chest didn't need, you know, they didn't need any help because the treatment stayed intact. So, you know, it was this kind of evidence, all the evidence presented, all the witnesses, all the experts all contradicted each other. They were basically undermined, but especially by Dr. Sack, the National Socialist defendant lawyer, incidentally. So, of course, van der Lubbe had two more fires he was going to set after the Reichstag. He wasn't planning to get caught. It was going to be the palace and the cathedral in the capital. So,
well, those are certainly symbolic buildings and certainly
all government.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wanted to specifically burn government buildings as his protest. The Cernovitz legend. What should I say about this? Okay, so this is communist lies are at the basis of National Socialist involvement in the fire. There's a widespread belief that van der Lubbe had close associations with National Socialists shortly before the fire. And this is apparently the result of deliberate communist juggling with the facts. So basically what they said is that he had stayed in Czernowitz and made contact with SA men who were his accomplices. So anyone that says the SA was behind the Reichstag fire, this is basically at the basis of that. The whole SA involvement, his accomplices, it's called the Czernowitz legend. That's how Tobias refers to it, what went down in Czernowitz. Basically, what happened is van der Lubbe allegedly had made contact with Oskar Sommer and the mayor of Czernowitz, and that therein became the basis for NS involvement with him. So basically, you know, the communist idea was that they had this meeting in Czernowitz. He met with the mayor and this Oskar Sommer. And then that therein implicated the National Socialists in the Reichstag fire. So, you know, this is a big communist lie. I guess that's all I really need to say on that.
Sure.
The name of the real swindler, because there apparently was a man who had swindled the mayor, and his real name was Wilhelm Barge. And so that exonerated Sommer of being swindled by Marinus van der Lubbe and somehow involved with him. And that was put forth in the Brown Book. So that was Willy Münzenberg and his little Paris operation there. And he was a communist refugee, quote unquote, who had fled Germany and gone to Paris and set up his headquarters there. This guy had like an entire trust of numerous front organizations that all participated in what he called his anti-swastika or anti-fascist crusade. And Münzenberg was extremely effective at winning over progressives and liberals to the communist agenda, even if it wasn't like overtly communist. Like they didn't say, yeah, I support communism, but I support the ideas of this front organization or that front organization because they didn't know that it was part and parcel of the Comintern and Willie Mintzenberg's agenda. And he was the head of Agitprop, which is like agitation and propaganda for the Communist International. So, you know, they were duped by all these front organizations. And of course, the Brown Book, you know, this is part of that. That was his little pet. The Brown Book is also where we get the homosexual lie that Marinus van der Lubbe was a homosexual. Absolute lie. Couldn't be corroborated by any of his friends or anyone who knew him.
But isn't that the thing that people always remember?
Exactly. And the thing is we still get this today where, you know, somebody will say, oh, yeah, Hitler used the Reichstag fire. He orchestrated it. And what these people don't realize today, I mean, this comes from like Alex Jones and stuff, is that you're reiterating the lies of the communist agitprop and Willy Münzenberg.
Yes.
Are saying exactly what Münzenberg said back in 33 and thereafter. I have the Brown Book. It's like what they did is they published the Brown Book and then put all his little articles that he would release in like little, almost like a periodical, right. Kind of like a daily. They put them together in these books. So you can get them still and read their lies. And it's just incredible. He implicated whoever he wanted. It's just, he just put whoever's name in there. And see, the thing is what made it so effective and what dupes people even today is Münzenberg would pick someone who had committed suicide for a very totally unrelated reason and a compelling reason, very compelling, totally unrelated to the fire, and use that person and implicate them. And what he would suggest is, this man committed suicide because he was involved.
Right.
And the National Socialists had to commit suicide, you know, on him, had to make him commit suicide, quote unquote. Basically, they murdered him and made it look like a suicide to keep him quiet.
Right.
Because, right. And it would be like a fireman. For instance, there was a fireman. It was the fire chief, in fact. I can't think of his name right off the bat, and I'm not on the page, but people can just read the book and get it. But he committed suicide because he had been guilty of bribery and corruption. He had been taking like thousands of marks in addition to his rather high salary, especially for the time period when many Germans were unemployed, from a company, can't think of the name of it. They sold fire extinguishers. So basically, it was a kickback he was receiving to push this company's product, being the fire chief. So they said, we'll give you money if you, you know, put in a good name for us and make sure the fire department puts in just our fire extinguishers.
Right.
And so he was caught in that. Well, in Germany, losing face like that, especially in front of the people and, you know, having it go public and be reported was a big deal. And he and a couple other firemen who were implicated committed suicide for that reason. One of them had even gotten a motor car, you know, a brand new Mercedes or whatever.
Whoa.
So, you know, the public is, of course, told something a little different. They were told about the car. And they were also told, the public was told that he had tolerated communist intrigues in the fire department. Whether or not that was true could have been part of it. That could have been. But the National Socialist government only gave the public a little piece of the truth. They kept more or less that bribery thing more private. So that wasn't put out as the reason why he was dismissed from being the fire chief. But that was the real reason. And Tobias, of course, has access to that because, you know, we're looking at this in retrospect now. We have all the information, all the facts.
Right.
So the government wasn't lying to the people. They were just omitting the bribery part. And I think they did that because they kind of wanted to protect the company and stuff from bad name. And these were all Prussian officials. None of them were Jewish. None of them were Marxists. They were all good German Prussian.
Right.
And so it looked bad for Germany to have all this corruption and bribery going on when they're trying to point out the specific enemies of the state. It's just basically perception management, as any government has to do. So the lie that the Reichstag was a symbol of democracy, that is a legend. It was actually considered a hideous waste of money and an eyesore. Everyone hated the Reichstag. And, you know, it just took years and years to build and all this stuff. So basically, this is another myth that's put out and believed today, that Hitler wanted to burn the Reichstag especially so because it was, he just hated democracy so much. Hated the fact that people could vote and have any say. Oh, I hate the people and I hate democracy.
That is so ridiculous.
Symbol of it. No, 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 no. That's not what happened at all, as we know. So that's put down. Of course, Douglas Reed was, he was one of the ones who, you know, watched this whole trial. He was one of the international reporters who was allowed to report on it. The only ones who weren't allowed to witness the trial and hear everything as far as reporters were just blatant lying reporters, ones that were carrying the lies of the Brown Book and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Stefan Delmer was there, too, by the way. And he was implicated in the Brown Book. That's how he figured out it was a lie. He's like, wait a minute here. I didn't submit a report to the Daily. I think he was the Daily Mail correspondent. I didn't submit a report to the Daily Mail saying that the National Socialists were involved, were behind Vanderbilt. I didn't say this. So he knew right off the bat that the Brown Book, you know, dailies or reports going out were lies.
Right. Now,
because it was implicated wrongly.
Now, didn't Douglas Reed write a book, The Burning of the Reichstag?
He may have. And I imagine Reed must have been more or less objective because he suspected that there were no accomplices. He's like, you know, I'm not really seeing the accomplice thing here. I kind of think this kid did it on his own. I think he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
So I don't think Reed would have been too hostile to either side. He seemed to try to just be getting the facts. But he did, as every journalist noticed, that it was being politicized. And rightly so. It was a civil war between two of the biggest political parties in Germany, the National Socialists and the Communists. This was
right.
Like the final battle. And so both of them used it to the utmost for PR purposes for their side. So, of course, the journalists are all looking at it going, you know, this is really getting political. It
right.
Should just be a criminal investigation or a criminal trial. Well, not in the context. Again, it's an extraordinary circumstance here. So, and of course, Tobias does mention that. You know, he talks about the Civil War for 15 years, and basically the fire was considered the last political battle.
Right.
That's probably really about it. When Goebbels first got the phone call from Ernst Hanfstengel, he thought he was joking around and he actually slammed the receiver down on him. He's like, quit with your jokes, Pootsie, and hung up the phone. And he's like, this isn't a joke. The Reichstag really is on fire. And so, you know, Goebbels' reaction, completely genuine.
Oh, you know, absolutely. Yes.
Done. It's not like how Bush reacted to the 9/11 news.
Right.
You're looking at him going, he knew, you know.
Sure.
Get the genuine surprise reaction from that at all. Whereas with the Reichstag fire, definitely genuine. Of course, Malmsteen goes into the genuine reactions of Hitler and Goering as well. And Hitler supposedly screams at the top of his lungs. I doubt that. I doubt he was screaming at the communists.
But, you know,
probably a little loud, but they always say he was screaming.
Exactly. No matter what you're talking about, he was always screaming.
I've never heard Hitler scream in any speech either, and they act like he's just out of control, and it's like, where are you getting screaming from?
Exactly.
Might hit high pitch a couple times, but not screaming and tearing carpets apart, etc., and hurting people's feelings all the time. That's all lies. That screaming at the top of his lung, that comes from Diehls. He was the head of Gestapo. One that says that, and Diehls had his own reason for painting Hitler as kind of, a little nutty.
Well, this is a very relatively short book, and I believe it's available online as a PDF file, and I think it has a lot of very interesting facts and things in it, and as you say, Tobias was certainly not pro NSDAP or
Right.
pro Hitler, and but I think it would be an interesting read for anyone that really wants to know the truth,
Right.
and
Yeah, and Hitler wasn't even the one who the Reichstag fire decree, that wasn't Hitler's idea. It was Grauert's idea, and then it was picked up by Frick, and it gave it basically what followed kind of a legal basis for suspending constitutional rights. And
Oh, right, yes.
so everyone goes, oh, yeah, Hitler planned this. It was all Hitler, Hitler. No, he was thinking elections, and it wasn't even him that came up with any of this. It was
Right.
Grauert and Frick. So, anybody that says, oh, yeah, Hitler used, he was the real mastermind behind that Reichstag fire decree. It was not a cabinet meeting that night. It was just an impromptu meeting where they kind of drafted up this decree based on previous decrees from the Bruning administration. He had also ruled by decree, and so had Hindenburg. Okay, we were in a civil war situation here. So everybody was ruling by decree and infringing on civil rights, etc. And of course, there was no gun law that went into effect after the Reichstag fire. I don't know where that's coming from. The gun laws were amended slightly after Kristallnacht because the National Socialists realized that somebody had instigated that pogrom. And so they were going to crack down a little bit. And the only changes they made were Jews and gypsies could no longer have guns. But before Kristallnacht, Jews had guns. They could have a gun.
Right. Everybody had a gun.
Yeah. So I don't know where that Reichstag fire gun law thing comes in. Somebody made that up, and then it's just a rumor that kind of took off on the internet, I think.
Sure.
So that never happened. And of course, the Reichstag fire decree was hardly ever used. So even though it was enacted after the fire, Goering very rarely used it. So if you're gonna, again, if you're gonna have a fire and orchestrate it to pass a certain legislation or decree to use, then why not use it? That's something that people just aren't aware of much.
Right.
And then, of course, Hitler did not exert any pressure on anyone to sign this decree. And, the Enabling Act, everybody voted on that. The man was voted into power. He was appointed by Hindenburg and then voted into power. There was no pressure. So that's another myth.
But these myths have a life of their own. They really do.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's really basically all I can say about the book. People really should read it for all the details. It completely, with no doubt at all, any Hitler or NS complicity, orchestration, etc. in the fire. The SA had nothing to do with it. They all had alibis. One man was struck down with influenza. I believe it was Heines. The SA men were implicated in the Brown Book. Willy Münzenberg just made it up. The one guy had influenza that night. He certainly wasn't the incendiary or an accomplice. And the other SA man was in Gleiwitz. way over on the Polish border.
Right. So, another area of interest.
Exactly. And yeah, that's the one we'll go to next. Hopefully I'll have the white book by then, because apparently the German government issued a report in their white book about Gleiwitz, and I'd like to see that.
Yes, that would be very interesting.
Yeah, before we do our show on that, because they conducted their own investigation of that and found nothing, as far as I know. And what's kind of interesting about Gleiwitz is the individual that conducted the investigation was Arthur Naba, and he turned out to be an anti-Hitler conspirator. So that's why I want to see his report findings in the white book, because he could have had a modus of his own.
Right.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's about it. I think we've covered everything.
Well, this is very interesting, and I really think that that people need to read this.
Absolutely. And unless you can think of any other questions related to the fire, I think Kristallnacht's been completely debunked as far as NS involvement in that. There is absolutely zero evidence that they had anything to do with it. And the same goes with the Reichstag fire.
And those are the two big things that people use and say, see what those Nazis did? See how they went after the Jews? I mean, they use these things and they refer to them as those false flags. Oh, let's blame the communists, or let's, you know, it's just amazing.
Right. I mean, if people want to complain about the Third Reich, there's legitimate complaint there from like somebody who's of liberal democratic leanings. One can simply take Hitler to task for politicizing the trial or the law, which basically in any country, you know, the government politicizes everything. I mean, it's not like our own trials and stuff, especially of these so-called terrorists, isn't politicized. It's all trumped up nonsense.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, if you want to attack Hitler on that premise, fine, fair game. If you want to attack him for beheading, you know, political opponents such as Marinus van der Lubbe, okay. You know, I consider that a legitimate attack from certain people that believe certain things about human justice, etc. But there's no need to make up lies.
Right.
You know?
But that's what communists are the best at. They make up
exactly.
A lot of lies.
Right. So my whole question is, if it's not enough to go after Hitler on the basis of what we could legitimately complain about, why would we need to lie about him? Obviously, he wasn't that bad.
Right.
In fact, he was quite good. And he didn't usually go extreme unless the circumstances called for it. And again, Marinus van der Lubbe, we're talking about a civil war situation. A foreigner comes to his country, you know, burns down all the, attempts to burn down all these buildings, does burn one pretty significantly. This foreign interloper, I just got into power. Excuse me, I'm going to go with the fullest extent of the law here.
Sure.
So that didn't happen that often. Usually he was pretty lenient. He was very lenient to Torgler, and Torgler ended up doing very well under the NS regime, and he denounced communism. He walked away from it. And the reason being is because Münzenberg and company betrayed him and basically wrote him off as a dead man and said, we're not going to help you at all. That's how he treated him. Because he had asked for his help. He had asked for like an attorney or some kind of assistance from Münzenberg and his committee over there in Paris, and they said, we have none for you. Good luck. So Torgler went, you know, with friends like that.
Who needs enemies?
Did it. Exactly. And he quit doing it. And, you know, Hitler actually kind of admired Torgler. He said, you know, he was such a smart man. It's too bad we didn't get to him sooner.
Right.
But he ended up doing pretty well under the NS regime, and he survived the war, unlike most of the National Socialist leaders.
Right.
So, and of course, so did Dimitrov. He ended up going to Moscow. And I suspect that if Marinus had actually made it to Russia proper, had actually gone to Moscow and encountered communism as it really was, he would not have been a communist anymore.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was.
Most of them turned away.
Sure. He was young and an idealistic, and, you know, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, he didn't see the real face of it.
Cost him his life.
Mm-hmm. And that's all I have.
All righty. Well, I really appreciate your scholarship and sharing this with us. And we will talk next week.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you.
All right. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.